Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Gunplay and ransom off the coast of Somalia have put piracy, of all things, back in the headlines in 2009. In 1776 and 7 and 8 and more, pirates were in the headlines too in London. That's what they called the high seas privateers of the American Revolution. Author Robert Patton tells the remarkable story of patriotism and gunpoint fortune seeking that helped win American independence. This hour, On Point, privateers and the American Revolution. You can join the conversation. Do you know the history of America's privateers? Do you have what the British called pirates in your family tree, your town history? How do you look back now on their motivations? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Robert Patton. He is the grandson of the great American World War II General George S. Patton and author of Patriot Pirates, The Privateer War for Freedom and Fortune in the American Revolution. Robert Patton, welcome to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here. Your book opens pretty early on with George Washington. He's in Boston. He's surrounded by a whole lot of British troops, and he doesn't have a navy. And he basically sort of sets loose some very able-bodied seamen to do some rough work on the high seas in the interest of independence.
Right. In the fall of 1775, he's really caught up in a stalemate surrounding Boston, but without the firepower or manpower to lay siege. And he's kind of frustrated in that waiting game he's forced to play. And all these Massachusetts watermen come forward with a lot of great ideas. And one of them is to arm and empower some privately owned warships to create in what was originally hybrids of Continental Navy men and private citizens into some armed schooners to blockade the Boston harbor approaches of British military ships and try to snag a few, both for the public lifting of the mood and also for the material gain of munitions and gunpowder.
And out of that, over time, and quite quickly actually, came the American privateers who became a more significant element in the American Revolution than I really understood until I read your book, Bob. Give us a sense of how important, who the privateers were, what they did, and how important it was in this independence movement.
You know, it's important to remember that, and George Washington himself said it, that the land war, as he called it, that is the what the Continental Army was trying to do, was essentially not lose, was to hold out against this vaunted British military machine long enough to force the great empire to tire of fighting. But as far as bringing the war to the British people and creating a real kind of offensive harassment, nothing compared with the American privateers. And this was something that I kind of stumbled upon. But when you look at the documentation, the statistics of the strategic elements of the war, what privateering did to the British economy, the impact it had on the psyche of the British people was huge. And if you look at even newspapers at the time in Britain, you find many more editorials cursing the depredations caused by these American pirates, so-called, than what Washington was doing on the ground war, as great and important as those activities were.
Give us a sense of the scale and reach and day in and day out reality of what those privateers did.
Well, simply enough, if you look at the Continental Navy, for example, only a handful of effective warships were ever put to sea. Congress, apart from being broke, had a lot of sort of internal divisions as to how to mount a sea threat. And after a lot of debate, once Congress decided to authorize privateers, citizen-owned warships, which was a time-honored tradition over many, many decades and hundreds of years of fighting. Once they came to that decision, it sort of tapped into a capitalist-slash-patriotic urge, which created, as opposed to maybe a dozen or so effective Continental Navy warships, thousands of American privately-owned armed schooners, converted fishing boats, trade vessels, and they went to sea in swarms, heading first into the sea lanes coming to North America, then down to the Caribbean, Caribbean, then and the West Indies, which of course were hubs of New World trade, going to Britain from its possessions in the New World, and finally going across the Atlantic to the very waters off of Great Britain and the European continent, just ravaging British trade and creating all sorts of havoc in the psyche of the British people and also Parliament.
This kind of blew my mind. Thousands of these, I'd never quite pictured that, nor had I pictured the reach, how active they were up and down the coast, all the way in the Caribbean, and then right in the heart of the British and even European coast, unlike Continental Navy warships. Well, I guess they did some of this too, but I mean, there really was only one goal here, and it was to take ships, to plunder booty, take supplies, and sell it for whatever it was worth, and do what with that money?
Well, first of all, just to backtrack one second, a Continental Navy soldier was entitled to some amount of the take of a captured prize, as it was called, if it stumbled upon an enemy trade vessel or a warship. But it wasn't near the percentage that was granted by law to a privateer. So there was but one a point in your Economics 101 to say the incentive was so much greater for a private citizen to join a crew of a privateer rather than to sign up for an extended enlistment in the Continental Navy or Army. That was one point which sort of made it more attractive to many people. Also,
there was huge money, real fortunes made here.
Well, simply enough, a Continental Navy man, a crew as a whole would say split one third of the take of a captured prize. That eventually, through the pushing of John Paul Jones, who of course was advocating for the uniformed services, he wanted to get it to a half at least to be divided among the crew. And if they captured a warship, a Continental Navy crew would get 100%. But compare that with a privateering venture, that is, the investors of the ship, the captains, the officers, down to the private crewmen. They got to take the whole 100% prize, the ship itself at auction and any cargo that it might hold. So right there you have a great incentive. And then, as I say, on top of that, much looser discipline, and also, and not to be discounted, a Continental Navy man was expected to attack an enemy warship, of course. That's what that's what warriors do, whereas the owners of a privateer would say, above all, avoid contact with the Royal Navy. We just want you to grab some nice unarmed, hapless trade ships wherever you can and send them back home for auction. So most people would say that sounds like a pretty good deal to me too.
What kind of cargoes were they taking then? When they took these juicy prizes, these ships at sea, what did they tend to have on board, and how big were the rewards?
Well, the rewards could be quite huge. And, of course, cargoes varied. But, for example, initially munitions and gunpowder were extremely valuable. But in looking at some of the research, you find where that kind of entrepreneurial impulse somewhat diverged from the war effort and saying, listen, if the markets right now are paying more for textiles or French goods, housewares, whatnot, look for those rather than gunpowder, which might serve the Continental Army. It just was the way of the world. People looked to the practical points of what a cargo would bring. So again, alcohol, African slaves, very valuable, as distasteful as we think of, but those were simply a commodity which could then be valuated, and the crews compensated for that value. A very controversial point where Massachusetts, for example, refused to allow that, but Rhode Island, always a bit of a rebel in the colonial grouping, said no. African slaves should be evaluated just as any other cargo. So again, this was some nuts and bolts capitalism at a very fundamental level.
The British were very straight up and loud, shrill about calling them pirates, pirates, pirates. But I was struck in the book that even in the United States, there was a real ambivalence about this. I mean, you mentioned John Paul Jones, of course, famous Revolutionary War era naval hero, and you write he was disgusted by the privateering phenomena. You quote him saying that this is actuated by no nobler principle than that of self-interest. This and this only determines all adventures in privateers, the owners as well as those whom they employ. On the other hand, you're talking about, I mean, a lot of this action comes out of my backyard sitting here in Boston. But up and down the coast, you've got a waterman out of Marblehead who I guess were involved in privateering. But they were also the ones that ferried Washington down to New York in 1776 and made history, pretty tough patriotic history, transporting troops across that Delaware River in his famous Christmas crossing. I mean, that was straight up patriotic sacrifice.
Very, very much so. It's a small world in those days. And if you were an expert mariner or navigator out of Essex County, north of Boston, with all those storied towns, Salem, Beverly, Marblehead, Gloucester, and you were capable of navigating offshore, Washington would find other uses for you later. And as you mentioned, there was a fellow, John Glover, who put together one of the early hybrid continental private armed schooners in late 1775. But then he also was, his men helped ferry Washington's men across the Delaware. They also helped evacuate Long Island when Washington was trying to get away from being cornered there in 1776 in really his first great action against British ground forces. And so these watermen, as I call them, these navigators, these Massachusetts saltwater colonials, they were a mixed group where they liked to make some money, but they were also about smiting the tyrant, as they said. They wanted to get America free.
It was all mixed up together, and you draw some extremely interesting conclusions out of that. We're going to go good and deep here with you, Bob Hatton. I'm very glad you're with us. You talk about the British initially saying that these vermin, they call them, would be easily crushed. It didn't turn out to be so easy. You quote a naval officer stationed in Boston, published in 76 or so in that winter in a London newspaper, who's saying about the, call them what he would call them pirates, the American called them privateers. He said, they are bold enough to dare and do anything. Whatever other vices they may have, cowardice is not one of them. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Patriot privateers, pirates, London called them, who helped win America's independence with cannon and cutlass on the high seas. My guest is Robert Bob Patton. He's the grandson of George S. Patton, General Patton, famous tank commander from World War II fame. He's written a new book called Patriot Pirates, The Privateer War for Freedom and Fortune in the American Revolution. A little bit of sound there, actually, from the 1940 movie Seahawk with Errol Flynn. There he's skippering an English privateer for Queen Elizabeth. That's well before the Revolution, but Bob Patton talked about the tradition of privateers. Here's a little sound from a bit after, but it gives a sense what this might have been like on the high seas. 2003 movie Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. Now it's 1805, and the British are fighting the French under Napoleon. Royal British Navy Captain Lucky Jack Aubrey, played by Russell Crowe, is off the coast of Brazil with his 28-gun HMS ship under sail. Aubrey's orders are to hunt down a French privateer. Here he rallies his crew.
Right, lads. Now, I know there's not a faint heart among you, and I know you're as anxious as I am to get into close action. We must bring him right up beside us before we spring this trap. That will test our nerve. And discipline will count just as much as courage. The Acheron is a tough nut to crack. More than twice our guns, more than twice our numbers. And they will sell their lives dearly. They mean to take us as a prize. And we are worth more to them undamaged. Their greed will be their downfall.
Russell Crowe in Master and Commander 2003. A little different year, British with a French privateer there, but you can very well imagine that same conversation with American privateers on the trail of Royal British ships in the midst of American Revolution. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you know the stories of the treasure-seeking privateers who sailed out of Boston, Providence, Philadelphia, Charleston? Can you see why George Washington cut the privateers loose to grab whatever booty they could take at gunpoint? And would America's privateers have understood, how would they have understood Somalia's pirates today? Privateers are just thought them pirates. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Let's get a call right off here from Suffolk, Virginia, and Robert. Robert, you're on the air with Bob Patton.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I still use silver my family took from the island of Martinique and at sea in the 1780s.
You're still eating, drinking off what they took in Martinique as privateers?
Well, some. Not a whole lot of pieces. A few French silver pieces with engravings on the forks, and the large silver English mug, I guess it's about a quart mug, has a coat of arms on it. I think that up and down the American seacoast here, there's a lot of shipbuilding, and we transported most things by sea, and people here were armed as well as the British, and why not? I think that they were probably the first people who were really free, and they probably inspired our revolution because of they were free.
Bob, Robert, let me ask you. Robert Patton calls his book Patriot Pirates. How do you see your ancestors who brought those tankards and cutlery back from Martinique?
Well, they sailed out of New Orleans. His name is Jean-Baptiste Lemaitre, I believe, and he had a small sloop with six cannons. He's a sailmaker. But I have on my in my study a leather tar hat from the War of 1812 used in the Battle of North Point in Baltimore, and they were mostly pirates, the Mechanics Fire Brigade. They were land pirates. They were pirates. In fact, some of them would get so drunk on their ships that they would attack anybody in the Chesapeake and just turn around. They didn't have to go to sea, whatever ship they came across. There was one pirate from Bell's Point in Baltimore who used to get so drunk, he would just, if he got a few miles out of Baltimore and he saw a ship, he took it.
But War of 1812, so a few years after the Revolutionary War, maybe.
They were still doing it. Sure. During the Revolution, after the Revolution. That was our second war for independence, really, I suppose, a continuation of the Revolutionary War was our War of 1812. 1814, the war was fought in Baltimore. But I still use a British tankard. It's a quart tankard made in London, 1699, by somebody named Lucan, and the joke in my family is if they can identify the coat of arms, we'll either give it back to them or take something else from them.
Robert, well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Bob Patton. There, he's still drinking out of the tankard. His privateer or pirate ancestor took, you name it.
Well, listen, I'm not at all surprised that silver would have come through Martinique, because Martinique was a hugely important center of French trade during the American Revolution and in that whole colonial period, and it became a point of destination for many American privateers who, in addition to operating in those waters around French-owned Martinique, would put into that port, contrary to the diplomatic agreements between Britain and France, put in that port to replenish their supplies, get ready for more voyages, but also to sell whatever prizes they'd captured. And this outraged the British crown and created a great deal of friction between Britain and France, which was of course the long-term plan of the American war effort, was to get that so-called friendship between France and Britain to split. And the activities around Martinique were very, very important to that effort.
Give us a sense of the range of vessels that went out as privateers in their size and crews and the range of targets they took on, Bob.
Initially, Tom, they were quite small. As I said, they were converted fishing vessels, trade ships, maybe 16, 18 crew, maybe four small cannon. But again, they're looking to grab unarmed vessels. But as the war progressed and that great ship design capability in New England and Mystic, Connecticut, and right on up into the great ports of northern Massachusetts, they begin to develop larger, faster sailing vessels, which have more cannon, maybe 16 guns or so. But you wanted to carry a lot of crew, and you wanted to have a lot of spare cargo space. Largely, you needed a good crew because, and a plentiful crew, because if you captured a vessel, say, many hundreds of miles offshore, you would put a prize crew aboard to sail it back home, to then auction it and collect money. You would have agents on shore to hold your money. Meanwhile, the main privateer would continue its voyage, try to grab another prize, put some more crew aboard, send it back home. So you needed to have a kind of a surplus of capable mariners, and that sort of impelled the ship design of the time to become larger, faster, because you want to get away from the enemy as well as catch the enemy, and also to have a room both for prize gear and a lot of crew.
We've got a question on just that front from Mike in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have two questions real quickly. First, nobody's mentioned what happened to the people on the ships that got captured. We hear about the cargo, but we never hear anything about the crew. And the second question I have is, do you have any information regarding whether or not the pirates ever got pirated?
Yeah, both great questions, Mike. Bob Patton, there was a lot of bloody exchange here. I mean, and what about the pirating of pirates?
I can tell you, first of all, on the captures of crewmen off of trade vessels, first of all, the privateers would try to get them to switch and join sides, which they had a lot of success at, because often merchant crews were sort of less passionate and committed than uniformed soldiers, and wearing British red. But also, and this infuriated John Paul Jones, the Jones wanted to collect British prisoners to allow then to have prisoners that they could exchange for captured American servicemen. And the privateers were not interested in holding prisoners. In fact, they infuriated Jones because they would just – the privateers, if they had – let's say they captured a crew of 20 or people off a vessel, they would try to put them ashore as soon as they could because they didn't want to take up space. They'd have to feed them. They'd have to clothe them, protect them, and they were taking up space on a ship, which they wanted to have room for the cargo and, as I say, to have crewmen to be able to put onto captured prizes to sail home. So they were very uninterested in keeping prisoners and really didn't abuse them particularly much either. As I say, their offenses to the British sensibility was stealing. They really weren't, I'm not saying that they were the kindest folk in the world, but we don't have a lot of instances of abuse of prisoners. They were more interested in just getting them off the ship and getting on about capturing some wealthy prizes. On your other question, were the privateers ever pirated themselves? Yes, indeed they were. One of the countermeasures that the British Crown reluctantly took was in 1777, they licensed privateers of their own. And some of the most vicious battles that I would find chronicled were between privateer and privateer, and not hard to understand because they really weren't sure how they were going to be treated by the other side if they were captured.
Right.
As an unrecognized privateer, you could be considered, therefore, a lawless pirate, and therefore you could be strung up on the yardarm right there. You were without any legal rights, according to that perception. And those battles, consequently, were really, really bloody and, from the point of view of an historian, very interesting. But to put oneself in those moments, it had to have been very, very harrowing.
And you write about some of those. And hundreds came out of Britain into the fray. But they also, these loyalists to the crown, that is, privateers, came out of New York. There were loyalists on this continent as well who joined the fray as privateers on the other side.
And they were more emotionally driven, I think, than anyone, because these loyalists in America, predominantly in New York, which remained largely loyalist throughout the war, had their lives utterly disrupted by this American Revolution. And therefore, when they took to sea to try to grab back some of the loot that was being taken from loot that was coming their way in the port of New York, they went with a special fury. And as I say, those engagements really stand out as you read the back and forth letters and the newspaper accounts of the period as being particularly bloody, blood pouring out of the scuppers down the sides of these vessels, whole vessels obliterated by single volleys from the side of a warship. Just very, very poignant, harrowing, but as I say, in a kind of an objective way, interesting way.
Let's go to Carter in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Carter. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Captain John Sinclair is our forefather in Virginia, and he was a privateer. Actually, after the war, he got run out of Smithfield. John Marshall assembled the militia, marched down, and I think he was doing a little bit too much action after the war and moved up to Gloucester, Virginia, and actually participated then in the War of 1812. He got back into it again. And the family legend is he led Admiral de Gasse in the French fleet. I mean, Admiral de Kopp in the French fleet for the siege of Yorktown.
It's a great story. How do you look back on him today, John? The family as a hero, as a rapscallion?
He is definitely a hero. I mean, and he's not referred to as. It's always Captain John Sinclair is how he's referred to. And since we were little, we've heard about Captain John Sinclair. I've even been to St. Eustatius and down the Caribbean because he traded down there, and they've got him on the manifest down in St. Eustatius.
Carter, thank you very much for that story. And Bob Patton, let's hold that one and get one more. We've got a lot of folks in the family here. Stephen in Salt Lake City, Utah. Stephen, you're on the air.
My middle name is Barry. I was named after one of the Commodore John Barry, who married my great-great-grandmother. And he was the first naval commission officer appointed by George Washington to start the U.S. Navy. And there's a book out by a gentleman named Loy called The Six Frigates. And it explains a lot about the privateering and what went on during the Revolution. And it's a very interesting situation. His ship was called the United States, built by a guy in Philadelphia named Humphreys, and his commission was to take the other ships and after the Revolution and go down to the Bahamas and police the privateers that were taking goods and booty out of the Bahamas.
Stephen, that's great. It's a kind of a crazy mixed up world here. I mean, people working all sides here, but you're ancestor, Barry, as a commissioned naval officer. Bob Patton, what do you make of these two stories? John Sinclair, Commodore Barry?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, the fellow that was speaking of Virginia, the way privateering moved, you know, born in the ports north of Boston, but it gradually spread as a lucrative, you know, fad right down the coastline and toward the end of the war. It very much was a major part of the economic life of Baltimore in Maryland and then into Virginia and ultimately the Carolinas. So, again, perfectly in keeping with what we understand of how privateering worked. The other side of it, you mentioned the Continental Navy. Ian Toll's book is terrific, Six Frigates. Many people in this that were involved in privateering also did periods and stints during the Revolution in the Continental Navy. Several of the skippers whose careers I chronicle have a year with a Continental Commission, and then they get out of that and they do privateering for a while. And as I say, someone like John Paul Jones, who was a purebred Navy man, had nothing but scorn for them. But these guys contributed hugely to the war effort. Most of them are forgotten today, unfortunately. But again, their impulse was a mixture of that desire to get ahead, to make some money, and, oh, by the way, whip the British as well.
Thanks. They're from Salt Lake City. Let's get a call from John in Cornwall, Vermont. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just was going to make the comment you asked earlier what the privateers of the 1700s would think of the pirates of Somalia today. Mm. And I was just going to make the rather pragmatic and realistic comment that, of course, they would have no sympathy for them at all because they're Africans and therefore were not, in those days, even considered human. So
yeah, there's a point.
They would have had absolutely no sympathy for what Somali pirates are doing, which seems to be much more for personal gain than to try and interfere with the lifeline of the British Empire, which was the Navy and the sea routes, which is what the privateers appear to have been mostly about.
John, good points all, and very realistic, I'm afraid, when it comes to race and Africans, racism there. But, I mean, Bob Patton, how about it? It's in a way an impossible question, but if you can imagine somehow these privateers looking out on Somali pirates today, what do you think they'd make? Would they recognize that and say, oh, there are cousins in Enterprise? Or would they say, these are scoundrels, nothing like us, period, end of story?
You know, I think the gentleman's point about the racism of the era sort of is obviously true. Mm. But as a way of examining parallels and how they might have fought one another, I think it's very kind of interesting to look at the Somali pirate phenomenon and to sort of appreciate in different dimensions. And I think the business model that they are looking at, i.e. that there are rewards out there that are worth the risks and also compared to the fact that they have no other real way to make any kind of way in their lives in this ravaged country of Somalia. But that business model was very much applied to the business model that the American privateers were looking at in the economic side. Of course, the privateers, some more than others, had a patriotic impulse. But while I would never question that, one has to say these were capitalists, these were entrepreneurs, and this was the great reason why they were out there. And they would, the racism aside, they absolutely would see their brothers in capitalist daring. And to understand the Somali pirate phenomenon, we have to understand that there's a business model presently at work that makes sense to them. We can talk about this or not, but
we'll come back after a break and look at exactly that, the money side of things here. You quote John Adams, the great John Adams, saying in October 1775, "It is prudent not to put virtue to too serious a test. I would use American virtue as sparingly as possible, lest we wear it out." And on come the privateers. Robert Patton's book is Patriot Pirates, The Privateer War for Freedom and Fortune in the American Revolution. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And we bore the stars and stripes, me boys, o'er the oceans of the world. From the proud flag of Britain, we swept the seas quite clear. And we earned our independence and the Yankee privateer. Then landsmen and sailors, let's give one more cheer. Here is 3 times 3 for the Yankee privateer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the near pirates who helped win American independence in the Revolutionary War, the privateers sanctioned by the Continental Congress to help in the war effort with Great Britain, the Empire. Robert Patton is with us. His book is Patriot Pirates, The Privateer War for Freedom and Fortune in the American Revolution. He is grandson of World War II legend General George Patton. Writing here about the privateers, what do you make of the story, the history of America's revolutionary era privateers? Here's Thomas Jefferson writing about the privateers early on, kind of amazed. He says, "The New Englanders are fitting out light vessels of war by which it is hoped we shall not only clear the seas and bays here of everything below the size of a ship of war, but that they will visit the coasts of Europe and distress the British trade in every part of the world. The adventurous genius and intrepidity of these people is amazing." Thomas Jefferson on the privateers. Let's get a call from Richard in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This topic is quite dear to my heart as I'm writing a dissertation on English privateering during the Restoration period in the 17th century.
Okay.
What I found is that privateering is a case example of how the fine line between state and private interests was often blurred during times of war. Hmm. There are many examples of important officials of a government that sponsors privateering themselves having a hand in this private business enterprise. You mentioned in your book General Nathaniel Greene's investment in privateers. My research has found that not other than Samuel Pepys himself, the Secretary of the Admiralty during the Second Anglo-Dutch Naval War, himself had a stake in an English privateer that caused a diplomatic uproar by capturing not an enemy vessel but that of an ally, in this case, Sweden.
Hmm.
What I think the relevance of our topic today perhaps lies more in reexamining this fine line and interrelationship between state and private interests in time of war, rather than the comparison to Somalian pirates. And I'm thinking of the example of Halliburton, private military contractors in Iraq.
Which Dick Cheney ran before he deployed in the Iraq War. It's a great point, and there's a lot in Robert Patton's book. Richard, stick with us for a second. Bob Patton, take that up. I mean, you describe all kinds of people on all sides investing in this. Paul Revere made a killing at one point. Richard brings up Nathaniel Greene, what may be Washington's very best general, deeply involved at the same time in financing privateers and hoping for the fortune that that would come there. Give us a sense of that intermeshing, Bob Patton.
Well, it was legal. Remember, it was legal as far as the Continental Congress thought, but it was kind of embarrassing. Do you know? Now, George Washington is known to have invested in at least one during the war, one privateer. Nathaniel Greene, while he was quartermaster general, which is in those days as a quartermaster general, you got to have a 1.5% commission on all expenditures in the military budget. Mm-hmm. So imagine if you could have 1.5% of the Pentagon budget today, you would be a very, very wealthy, wealthy man.
And then if you invested that in privateers and saw a big leverage?
Which is precisely what Nathaniel Greene did. But what the gentleman spoke about as well in the parallels with private contractors, I think is a very interesting one. For example, we've spoken already that John Paul Jones had nothing but scorn for the privateers. Well, many people in the uniformed services today are very angry at Blackwater, particularly on that incident of about a year ago with the killing of a number of folks in a shootout in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, I think at least in the beginning, there was a sense that the jobs that Blackwater was doing could at that time only be done by that sort of an entity, either for cost-effective reasons or for whatever the nature of the work. So there was a bit of a utility involved to whatever Blackwater was doing. But as time goes on and people begin to become more and more uncomfortable with that sort of outsourcing of military the jobs and necessity and what they must do in the line of duty, that becomes more and more of an uncomfortable prospect, and that's obviously what's happened in the public perception of Blackwater, and to a great measure that happened in the public perception of the privateers. They never were quite embraced by everyone in Congress, and certainly the American aristocrats of the period looked down on it and also looked down on those nouveau riche who made huge, immense fortunes during the war. Some of those fortunes exist today, and it's a classic example of this kind of waterfront, low-born element fighting its way through society for what at the time might seem sort of seamy, know, embarrassing mechanisms, but rising to the top and over time suddenly becoming the new elite, or, you know, that we all think of as American old money.
You do write about how the scale of this money at points turned people's heads in the cause of revolution. I mean, it got pretty murky in there sometimes, over in France, all over the place, where people were trying to represent American interests and simultaneously invest in privateers who could bring them a huge haul. It got to be a very complicated set of motivations for and all, sometimes even against or borderline.
Right, you're exactly right. And we've already spoken about sort of the drift of the fad of privateering, moving down the American coastline, eventually going into the West Indies, primarily basing out of French-owned Martinique. And then it, inevitably, as these daring entrepreneurs begin to reach farther and farther out in their voyages, it makes its way across the Atlantic. And what you have before the French alliance with America, you have privateers beginning to dart in and out of French ports for those same reasons that they went into Martinique, to resupply, to unload their captives, which, again, they didn't want to keep. They wanted to have room on their ships for prizes and prize crews, and also to sell their prizes. Outraging the British, creating friction between the two governments, and of course playing right into the hands of the diplomatic plan that Benjamin Franklin, as the lead commissioner there, had in mind from the beginning, was to use privateering to create a wedge between these two ostensibly friendly governments, France and Britain.
Let's go to Julie in New London, Connecticut. Richard, thanks for your call. Julie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I am so thrilled you've selected this subject. I actually manage a schooner called the John Paul Jones out of New London, Connecticut. And my question is, perhaps Jones was a little concerned about what was going to happen after the war with these thousands of ships going around the seas with the main desire to snatch booty. Is there any documentation on what actually happened to most of the privateers after the war was over? Thank you.
That's a great question, Julie. Bob Patton?
I can tell you the privateering commissions, the commissions were all sort of deauthorized at the end of the war, 1783. And indeed, there were a lot of very capable mariners, navigators, armed vessels, and itchy capitalist waterfront entrepreneurs that wanted to sort of what shall we do next? Many went into trade, but that was somewhat difficult in this immediate post-war period where the economy took a downturn. And what one finds, and this is, again, this is American economic history, a lot of these vessels, a lot of these investing entrepreneurial families looked around and said, well, what should we do with this capability we have? And they went into the slave trade. And if you look at many of the vessels that were involved in this post-war slave trade between the Revolution and the Civil War, they were either converted privateers or captured vessels that had been taken in by the privateers and were used to transport African slaves. And again, it's important to remember that this was the triangular trade in that, to go over it quickly, let's say we have some distilled spirits from New England. Those are sent to Britain or Africa, converted to cash, then down to West Africa to purchase the African slaves, then brought via the awful Middle Passage down to the West Indies, where the slaves are usually converted for molasses or cane sugar, then brought back to New England and distilled into spirits, i.e. A human being, a human slave, never has to set foot in Puritan New England for this enterprise to go on full bore. And one sees, after the war, not a large number, but a significant number of privateers and privateering investors getting into this trade very, very carefully sub rosa, not to be noticed by the public, but it's there. And in fact, I found a startling statistic that 3/5 of all vessels that were involved in the slave trade that came out of New England between the Revolution and the Civil War, 3/5 originated from little old Rhode Island. And Rhode Island, of course, was a privateering epicenter, a huge entrepreneurial, aggressive colony geared smuggling before the Revolution, privateering during, and not a lot of families, but those that were involved did it significantly in the slave trade afterward.
And, of course, the Brown family, as in Brown University today, won central to that.
Yes, my alma mater actually had to went through a very, very deep investigation of I won't say its founders, but the school was named for a bequest given in the name of John Brown, who was a very, very important Providence-based capitalist, made canon, also heavily into privateering and trade, and then after the war, very heavily involved in the slave trade. His brother Moses was an abolitionist and had terrible feuds with his brother over this obviously very volatile matter. But that element of John Brown's participation awakened the Brown University a study of the possibility, the justification for reparations. I don't know whether they came up with an answer for that, obviously pretty difficult and complicated question, but it shows you how this privateering history, which I sort of stumbled into, just awakened all these elements of a strategic understanding of the war, an economic understanding of the war, which had its ultimate ramifications in the slave trade, and its political ramifications on the war as a wedge between Britain and France.
You also write about it breaking open a kind of new model for American capitalism, taking it out of single families, because these privateers were often sponsored by a group of individuals who will come together, like the gang group Paul Revere got into, just to cite one among many others. But after the war, you still had people outside of family connections coming together to sponsor high-risk, high-reward journeys, let's say, like the China trade, which also called on this population.
You know, this is another example of, as I say, my allowing my ignorance to be my guide and diving into this subject of privateering. And what it awakened in me, you would think, well, what could be a bigger snooze than studying the economics of the American Revolution? But, you know, it's so important to understand what constraints and difficulties Congress was under and how privateering did bring in, you know, hard goods, hard money, and which was able to keep the overall American project moving forward. And as you mentioned, before the Revolution, the American business model was very much a clannish. One did business with your family, with your brother, so-and-so and brothers and company, or so-and-so son and company. Privateering was so dangerous, and so many thousands of vessels, we talked of the great fortunes that were made, well, most didn't survive. As one investor said, one success will pay for three or four losses. So those were the kind of odds we're talking, you know, one out of four might hit. But because of that, this formerly individualistic approach that Americans had to business, they were able now to hedge the risk by sharing it around. And that awakened this idea that maybe Americans could become more collective, first in their capitalism, but later in their politics. And I think that has a parallel in the growing, but not initially easy, American comfort with the idea of a central government afterward. I mean, instead of colonies, each for his own, they began to say, we can get together, i.e. a national bank, as Alexander Hamilton put forward. And that ability to be comfortable with a conglomerate approach, I think, was very importantly awakened in privateering.
You talked about fortunes made and family fortunes that went forward to become part of a later American aristocracy, even if they came up from the wharf in those days. Like what? Give us some names here.
Well, how about Joseph Peabody, just a teenage deckhand out of Salem, Massachusetts. By his ninth cruise, he went from a sort of the lowest deckhand, getting just a fraction of whatever take they would get. But he saved that. He then moved up the line. He was eventually a skipper of a vessel. By his ninth cruise, he owned several ships himself, and he became one of the largest and most successful waterfront merchants in American history. There are towns named after him, of course. He had 8,000 employees in
Salem. Built up from a beginning in privateering.
Built up from a teenage deckhand in privateering. And some families were fairly well-to-do beforehand, like the Browns, like the Tracys in Newburyport, the Cabots, some were a famous merchant family. But there were many others. Lowell in Massachusetts, he was they were attorneys. And you know that old saying about rather than a win or lose the game, it's better to own the game. Well, he was a lawyer that brokered these partnerships that we talked about between potential privateer investors. And he made a fortune and never had to actually go to sea himself. So one sees the kind of the tentacles of this operation moving through society. And as I say, what were sort of this grasping and brazen waterfront element, now we think of these family names as being the oldest of old American money.
Piracy can sound, in the movies, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean and all the rest, it becomes a kind of a great fun, jokey, but this was tough stuff. And when they were taken prisoner and not seen as as proper military combatants, the imprisonment conditions you describe pretty awful.
Yeah, they were. Again, it's all a matter of perspective. I mean, the American privateer would say, "Listen, we're at war. We have a legal commission. We can do. We can do as privateers have done through the millennia." But the British perspective, they said, "Congress is itself an illegitimate body. These are simply rebel outlaws. Therefore, any authorizations bearing Congress's signature are themselves inauthentic. Therefore, you are not a legal privateer. You are a pirate." And Parliament passed a law. It's by shorthand we call it the Pirate Act in March of 1777, a year after America and Continental Congress authorized privateers. And by virtue of that law, any captured privateer could be held without the usual rights accorded a prisoner of war, i.e. no exchange, indefinite imprisonment, potentially could be hanged summarily right there. Few were, but that potential was always there. And no rights of habeas corpus or the civil rights accorded to normal, as I say, uniformed captured prisoners of war. And if you want to draw a parallels with what we've been through as a country in Guantanamo, I think they're amazingly apt. Doesn't even matter what side of the argument you care to fall on, one can read editorials coming out of newspapers in 1777, 1778 about how, from the perspective of one newspaper, say that we in Britain have completely forsaken our values as human beings by not according civil rights to these captured seamen.
Throwing them in the black hole or on the floating prisons
that were absolutely
dreadful.
And we see the same. We saw the same kind of fracturing in the editorials in American newspapers over Guantanamo. Again, it's my late aunt used to always say, "There's nothing new under the sun," and this was a case of definitely a reprise of that old debate Guantanamo, something that had happened many, many years ago in Britain. As far as the fate of prisoners, not so bad if you were brought to Britain. There were two prisons, that housed American captured seamen. About 100 Americans died there, but on the prison ships in America, at least 12,000 privateers died here in the East River between Manhattan and Brooklyn. Terrible, horrific neglect led to the death of thousands who died and are buried anonymously.
Which led to that kind of moral conundrum of the day in the UK, the empire of the time. Robert Patton's book is Patriot Pirates, The Privateer War for Freedom and Fortune in the American Revolution. Bob Patton, it's a fascinating story. You tell it well. Thank you very much for being with us today as we've again amazingly got pirates in the headlines. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.